will come to order at 3:22 p.m. on March 18th. With us today, we have Representative Thompson, Representative Sadler, Representative Miller, Representative Holmes, myself, Chair Olson. We have Speaker Chenault in transit, should be here shortly, and Representative Johnson is excused from this meeting. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your phones and your Blackberries. We have four items on the agenda today: House Bill 122, 155, 139, and House Bill 11. We will start out with House Bill 122. As a result of House Bill 155 sucking up all the oxygen in my office for the last couple weeks, we didn't have time to review the CS and amendments for House Bill 122, so we'll be carrying that one over. I apologize again, but we've been working our way through what has been a very time-consuming bill, and we'll be getting to the rest of the items that we have in Labor and Commerce as we can. So the next item on the calendar is House Bill 155. Jennifer, could you please come up to the table, and I would like to let everybody know that we do have a committee substitute that went out several days ago to this bill, and it's been distributed to the committee and to the public, and I would entertain a motion to adopt the SES for purposes of the discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the CS for HB 155.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Jennifer, can you walk us briefly through the changes?
Sure. He needs to do it
more specifically.
For the record, Mr. Chair, that's CS for HB 155. It's work draft 27-LS. That's Lima Sierra 0249/I.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Good afternoon, Jennifer Sinnett here, staff to Representative Olson. The legislation you have before you, the CS, the House Bill 155, this CS that you have in front of you right now, it's the product of extensive work done by the parties affected by House Bill 155. And I think we all know from the very beginning, from our very first hearing on this bill, House Bill 155 generated a lot of discussion from around the state. And after hours of public testimony, I know that committee members likely have a pretty good idea of where the affected parties stood on the issue. I think it's fair to say that we had the unions on one side, and we had the municipalities, the road service areas, and contractors on the other side. And there didn't seem to be a whole lot of common ground. And that's why I'm very pleased, and the representative is very pleased, to have this CS in front of you today, because this is compromise legislation, and it's the result of a lot of hard work by the parties involved.
And if I could break in at that point, for the people that haven't been aware of what's going on, about a week and a half ago, I was approached by the Alaska Municipal League and several of the public entities that were involved in bringing this bill to my attention. We've been working on this for almost a year. I was approached by Kathy Wasserman of the Municipal League and two representatives of organized Lager, Don Etheridge and Barbara Huff Tuckness, with the concept of them sitting down and coming together with something that all of the organizations could come to me with at the end. And it took them approximately a week, and they came to me Monday night at about 5 p.m. With a conceptual CS, which is what is before you. And I can let Jennifer walk you through there were significant changes that when all of us were at the table, nobody liked, but everybody could live with. There are portions that I don't particularly like, but aren't deal killers as far as I was concerned. I believe the unions, but I won't put words in their mouth because we have two of them that are going to be testifying in a few minutes. There were a number of issues they didn't like, but we all got something out of it and got something that we think we'll be able to get further through the process. At least it'll get through this committee, I believe. And with that, didn't mean to interrupt Jennifer, but
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So moving to the bill itself, you'll see three changes to the bill in the CS here. And the first one, it's pretty obvious, the title has changed. Originally, it was a very broad title, an act relating to public construction contracts. I think everyone realizes how broad that is. This has now been changed. It's a much more specific title now. It's about five lines longer. So that is that's change number one. The second change here, and this really gets to the meat of the discussions that were had between all the parties, second change is that the threshold has been put at $25,000. And third and finally, you'll notice that the definitions that were originally in Section 8 of the bill, they have now been taken out. And I think you'll remember that the definitions portion, that was a huge sticking point with some of the parties. And I think the committee probably got a glimpse into just how tricky some of these definitions were during our first hearing of the bill and during your subsequent, when you were browsing the Attorney General opinion from 1983. So those definitions and that Section 8 has now been taken out. So those are the three changes to the bill. And as the chairman said, the parties involved have all indicated that they can live with this, and Rep. Olson, as he said, we're all very pleased that they were able to work this out amongst themselves. And maybe just on more of an editorial note here, I think as you were listening to public testimony, it appeared that this maybe was an issue that pitted union versus non-union workers and then them versus municipalities or road service areas. And I think this legislation, or this CS here, it really symbolizes the representative's contention that this was never a union versus non-union issue, or, you know, an issue or a legislation that was aimed at one particular group. The issue here was an antiquated statute. And so this CS right here, this antiquated statute is now updated, and this dollar threshold amount, which was based on the federal dollar threshold amount based in 1935, that's now updated to fit more Alaska-specific 2011 standards. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think that will conclude my testimony.
I think I'm going to invite Don Etheridge to the table. Thanks, Jennifer. And I would like to acknowledge all the work that all three of the I don't even know, we had an informal name for you guys. I think the working group put into this. I have a rough idea on how much time that you put into it. It was greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Etheridge, representing the Alaska State AFL-CIO. And as Jennifer and the chair have said, we did put a lot of hours and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into this. And we have reached a compromise that all sides can live with. I think it's a fair compromise since everybody left and nobody was really happy, but we all left with the gratitude that we were able to come together on this issue and make it work. And I appreciate the chairman's indulgence with us over the time that we were trying to reach compromise. I thank the AML for working with us on this so that we could come up with something that we can walk through the system together and everybody come out and support. And with that, we are supportive of this piece of legislation.
Any questions for Don? Thanks again for the hard work.
Thank you.
Kathy Wasserman, are you with us?
I'm with you, sir. And I was awake.
And thank you for all the hard work on not only the AML, but the your entities like the Kenai Peninsula Borough and some of the other boroughs and school districts to put into this also.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. We thank you and Jennifer both for your help. As Don says, we probably all walked out of that first meeting all unhappy. So I figured that was a success. No one was terribly happy with the result, but it is something we can live with. And I think between Barbara and Don and I, we all looked at the possibilities, the scenarios that could happen, what the result could be, and had to sort of weigh that. And I'm sure that each one of us will have some members of our own that will have some pushback, but that's okay. Isn't it, Don?
Yes.
Yeah, that's okay. We're prepared for that, but we thought in the best interest of trying to get the job done that this would work for everyone. So, again, I want to thank you for everything you did, and I think we came to an agreement that really is beneficial to everyone and can be something we can all strive for in other articles of of bill and legislation.
Any questions for Kathy?
Thank you.
Kathy. Barbara, are you online by chance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation, and again, thank you for the real effort that you put into this also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I would sincerely like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, as well as the members of your committee for your time, effort, the committee members, and their indulgence many hours. And I will repeat many hours of testimony regarding this particular piece of legislation. In working with the Municipal League, I think we've come up with a product, probably just coin a phrase from the House co-chair of finance. Both parties walked away not happy with the bill, so it's got to be a good piece of legislation. I'll leave it at that. It is a product that, at least on behalf of my organization and the people that we represent, we will continue as the bill moves through the various committees to support the bill in its current form. And again, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your effort.
Thanks again, Barb. Any questions for Ms. Huff?
The Chairman, yes.
Mr. Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barbara, I'm not sure if you're the right person, the best person to ask this question or not, but I understand that there is some linkage between the level, this threshold of $25,000 and the level at which filings must be made to the Department of Labor on such contracts. I don't know if you're the best person, but can you explain that relationship?
I'm sorry,
Between the reporting requirements, I believe, to the Department of Labor and this contract threshold?
The $25,000 with respect to the filing fee, as well as the local hire provisions, I'm not real sure. The triggering amount for the filing fee is $25,000. So we actually walk in sync, which zeroed out ultimately the fiscal note from Department of Labor, but there's probably somebody from the department that might be able
to have somebody else
more eloquently to that.
Greg Mitchell, are you with us?
I'm here.
He's right there.
Oh, here, come on up.
He is indeed, Mr. Chairman.
Patrick.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Gray Mitchell, Director of Labor Standards and Safety Division at Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And what Barbara had answered is essentially correct. The $25,000 threshold would match the threshold that's currently established for a filing fee. So this change would, in effect, zero out the fiscal note. So the $25,000 threshold would now be consistent for both application of Little Davis-Bacon Act and the filing fee requirement.
Thank you, the Chair. Nice work. Thank you.
Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Well, with that, we closed out public testimony last week. I will remove my objection. Is there further any further objection to the CS? With that, that brings the whole bill back to the committee. And we've been joined by Representative Chenault. And we also have both of the Wilsons in the House in the room, I believe. One for Bill and one to
support or what?
Again, what are the wishes of the committee?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I would move passage of CS for HB 155 with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee, and we will take a well-earned brief at ease. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 139, Veterinary License Qualifications. And representing Peggy Wilson and her staff, Kyle Wisenhunt?
Wisenhunt.
Please join us and welcome to Labor and Commerce. Who's first? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate you hearing House Bill 139 today.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Representative Wilson from District 2. And the goal of the bill is to increase the number of veterinarians in the state of Alaska. Currently, the Board of Veterinary Examiners has only one option, one certification program that a veterinarian graduate who has graduated from another country can be certified in Alaska, and that's ECFVG, which is the Educational Commission for Foreign Veterinary Graduates. And that is because when the board was put in statute, there was only one possibility, and so that was the one that was put in for them to choose from. But House Bill 139 will change the statute to allow the Board of Veterinary Examiners to the ability to choose which certification program would be acceptable in the state of Alaska. As legislators, we are not qualified to evaluate veterinary programs, obviously, unless one of us was a veterinarian. As new programs are developed, I believe we should have our veterinary experts evaluate which programs are appropriate for licensure in Alaska. And in 2003, another program in the United States was developed, and so now there's more than now there is another one, another option. There are 32.
Isn't that a function of the board, the veterinarian board?
Yes, and that's what this bill does, because in
don't they do it already? Is what I mean.
They can't, because in statute it only has one listed.
But they can come to us with the recommendation that they had.
Yes, and that's what we're doing here. We're changing the statute so that they can make their own decision of what option they would like. We're not
well,
telling
again, them. Well, again, did the veterinarian board or the board of veterinary?
Board of veterinary.
Right. Did they come to you with this bill?
Actually, two different people that were veterinarians that came to Alaska that can't get certified unless they spend $6,000. And so that was the whole gist of it. But and so since 2003, there have been 32 states and two territories that now use both of the programs that currently exist. And I believe our state board of examiners should have the latitude to accept either program or change programs if there's more that would pop up. Or just keep the one they have. That's up to them. This bill just allows them the option of doing what they do best. And my intern, Kyle Wisenhunt, will give a little more background information on this bill.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wisenhunt. I'm a student intern in the office of Representative Peggy Wilson, but most folks just call me Kyle. As the representative stated earlier, this bill simply gives the Board of Veterinary Examiners the latitude to choose which certification program for veterinarian graduates of foreign universities. This bill is not about the programs themselves. However, here is a little bit of background on our bill and the programs themselves. The idea for this bill came about last session when our office received an email from a constituent. He complained that his wife could not practice veterinary medicine in Alaska, even though she was already licensed in three other states. His wife is a graduate of a foreign university. She graduated from St. George's University in Granada and then completed her clinical year at the University of Minnesota. To ensure she could practice veterinary medicine in the United States, she completed the Program of the Assessment of Veterinary Education Equivalence, or what's otherwise known as PAVE. PAVE is one of two certification programs that is offered. She is not able to practice veterinary medicine in Alaska because Alaska is currently exclusively accepts the other certification program, which is known as the Educational Commission for Foreign Veterinary Graduates, or ECFVG. She currently practices in Washington and California. She has researched the requirements to complete the ECFVG program and found that completing it would require two round trips to the to one of the testing locations in the lower 48, and the test will cost a minimum of $6,000. And that is if all sections are passed the first time. This constituent then asked Representative Wilson to introduce legislation that would allow the state of Alaska to accept both programs. Now, PAVE was started in 2000, and 32 states now accept it. There is a detailed description in each of your packets about this program. Much research has been done in different states comparing the two programs, and they show PAVE as equivalent to ECFVG. Washington and Idaho are two of the 32 states who have accepted PAVE, and also in each of your packets is research that Idaho has conducted. Since 2000 and 2006 and 2007, the year PAVE has been accepted in Washington and Idaho, neither Idaho nor Washington has had issues with their PAVE accepted students. Online, we have Karen Ewing, who is the executive director of the Idaho Board of Veterinary Medicine. If you have any questions about some of the research they have, she is online. Bill HB 139 will empower the Board of Veterinary Examiners to select the program to use, be that ECFVG, PAVE, or if they want to use both. They are the Board of Veterinary Examiners. They are the professionals who are appointed by the governor. Four of the five members of the board are licensed veterinarians. The other seat is a public member. In your packet is a copy of the webpage with their mission statement that says, and I quote, "The board adopts regulations to carry out laws governing veterinary practice in Alaska. It makes final licensing decisions and takes disciplinary actions against people who violate licensing laws," end quote. Currently, in the Alaska state statute, the statute precludes the board from making a licensing decision by directing foreign university graduates to a specific program. If the board would like to accept PAVE as well as ECFVG, they should have the ability to do so. Thank you for your time in considering this matter, and we're open for questions.
Representative Chenault.
My question was answered, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and your explanation. I just have one brief question. On page 2 of the bill, line 2, indicates that under all of these other conditions, the board shall approve the issuance. And there are maybe 5 items listed here. Could we perhaps soften that language a little bit, that they would be permitted to issue approval? If, for example, and I have no knowledge of this, that maybe there are 10 or 15 criteria that they look at over and above the ones we've listed here.
That's the current statute as it is now, and the only the underlined is what I'm adding.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we're going to open up public testimony now, and I think we'll start with Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, room's full of Wilsons.
Welcome, Dr. Wilson. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
My name is Dr. Myra Wilson. I'm a veterinarian licensed in the state of Alaska. I'm here actually representing the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association. I'm the secretary. I've been the secretary for about 7 years. I'm a past president of the association also. Our president couldn't be here in person, so I got to spend a beautiful day in Juneau instead.
Who's the current president?
Pardon me?
Who is the
Dr. James Delker.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I believe he may be trying to phone in on.
I think he's on the list.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why I was asking.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify today. We as an association represent over 150 licensed veterinarians in the state of Alaska. We have members from Fairbanks, Delta Junction, Matsu Valley, Kenai, Seward, Valdez, Kodiak, I believe Wrangell, Juneau, and Ketchikan. And we are opposed to this bill because we just don't think it's a good bill for the citizens of Alaska. We feel that there's ambiguity in turning over licensing standards to a five-member board that's appointed by the governor on a rotating basis. The ECFVG is recognized right now by 50 states. It's recognized by Canada, and it is the only certification program that has the United States Federal Regulatory Commission's approval. So we feel that that's important that all 50 states recognize the same statute that we're recognizing along with the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association and the United States Federal Regulatory Commission. We feel like also that given this bill, citizens will not know what their veterinarian's qualifications are. I think if you go in as a citizen, you would expect certain qualifications to be met by your veterinarian. And when you have ambiguity on which certification program is being approved by a rotating board, I think those expectations become very ambiguous by not only citizens not knowing, but as a small business owner, if you're hiring a veterinarian, I think you would also want, if they're licensed in the state of Alaska, to have some understanding of what sort of credentials and equivalency program that they've passed on a very standard level. This statute's represented Alaska for the past several years. It's worked well. I think we have high standards of profession amongst our veterinarians, and we as an association feel like we'd like to keep it that way. We just think that there's too much ambiguity with this bill by putting it into the hands of five individuals that rotate. And thank you for the opportunity.
Question from Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it the association's, the problem with the bill, is it the PAVE certification, or is it the ability of the board to make and change the standards, or is it both that concerns the association?
Well, we as an association are addressing the bill that was put before us, which has no mention of PAVE. It just talks about the board being able to pick and choose what accreditation program they want.
May I follow up?
Follow.
Does the association have a position on the PAVE certification?
I can't speak for the association. I would have to go back, and I guess we would have to meet as a group and poll our membership and get some information on that back to the board.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, just to clarify, are you testifying for yourself only, or are you representing, is your opposition?
I'm representing the state association.
Okay, good. So you are.
Yes. Yes.
Representative Miller.
Do you know, is this board a new creation with this bill, or they already exist?
The Veterinary Licensing Examining Board?
Yes, ma'am.
They already exist.
And how are they structured? I mean, who's qualified to sit up? Or how does that board come together? What's its composition?
My understanding, and I don't know all the details, but I believe there are four licensed veterinarians in the state of Alaska and one layperson. So it's a five-member board. And I believe they have a rotating term so that not everybody leaves at the same time.
And I would assume that you have confidence in each of the, let's say, the veterinarians who are licensed in their ability to judge what someone else's credentials may or may not be.
Well, I think that might be a question you might ask the people on the examining board, how they would feel about judging those credentials.
Let me be hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's say that you're on the board.
Mm-hmm.
You are a licensed veterinarian.
Uh-huh.
And I show up with questionable credentials. Would you be able to, through a process that you and your board members get to determine whether or not I was actually capable of carrying out duties?
Actually, I might be able to help you on that. We have the chair of the board online, and we'll be getting to him in a few minutes.
Okay.
Fine.
Did you want me to? Not to get into details of PAVE and ECFVG, because they're both very complex, but there is one of those tests that does require every candidate to complete a clinical competency test after graduation. And not all of PAVE graduates are required to do that. So you're kind of comparing sometimes apples to oranges.
Okay.
So
that helps.
I hope that helps.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, the question maybe for you or maybe for the chair of the Veterans Board of Veterinary Examiners. Can anyone answer how many veterans in Alaska currently are practicing through certification under the ECFVC?
Probably all of them, because that's all that statute allows right now.
But this is foreign people who've gone through a foreign veterinary school and practicing under this.
Oh, so how many people? I don't know the answer to that. I would think that maybe the Division of Occupational Licensing would have that information.
Do we have that person available, my chance?
We've got Don here. I don't know if Don will wing it, but
we as a state association, I wouldn't have that information.
Mr. Chair, are we waiting?
Everybody done with Dr. Wilson?
Sure.
Thanks again, Dr. Wilson.
Yes, thank
Don,
you for your time.
Don, you're here to join us and shed some light on welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Seems like you were just here a couple days ago.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Don Habiger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't have that number, but I can get it to you.
It's a big buildup there.
Can you get it to us by next week?
Uh-huh. I will try to get it to you Monday.
Anything else we should
have him do?
No.
Nope. That was easy. Thanks again, Don. Do we have anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Then why don't we go to the gentleman with all the answers. Dr. David Hunt, are you online?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you again for participating today.
My name's David Hunt, and I am the chairman of the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Currently, our state does not accept PAVE. That is the Program for Assessment of Veterinary Educational Equivalent. The Board of Veterinary Examiners has researched PAVE and is supportive of accepting it. We had a presentation from the PAVE committee at our board meeting in Fairbanks in 2009. I've been to the National Board of Veterinary Examiners meeting for the past 5 years and have learned about the PAVE program. The board is on record that it is supportive of accepting PAVE, and we have determined it is equal to the standards of ECFGV, the test now being used for foreign graduates given by the AVMA. This bill allows the board to decide which programs to accept for veterinary licensing in the state of Alaska and accept the PAVE program. Are there any questions?
At least one, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hunt, I would ask the same question of you that we asked of Mr. Habiger. Do we know how many vets in Alaska are now, how many veterinarians practicing in Alaska graduated from foreign schools and were certified under the ECFVC?
I'm not quite sure what that number is. I don't think it's very large. We don't think we get a lot of foreign graduates up here. Probably maybe less than 10, but I think Don, our the person who runs our board would be better to answer that question because she has all those figures at the she's our secretary at the board.
That'd be good to know, I guess. And actually, two more questions, and you may or may not be able to answer them. Any idea as to how many veterinarians would be likely to seek to practice in Alaska who were went through foreign schools and sought licensing through the PAVE program?
Well, I just know of one, and that's the gal in Homer. And I don't think you're going to get a rush of people trying to get into this program, but it's a solid program, and I think down the road in the future, I think it's an important program, and eventually I'm sure all the states are going to be accepting it. I mean, it's just as good as the ECFGV, and, you know, I've been pretty well educated on it, both from going to the meeting each year, and I think it will be accepted. I think that the bill set up that, you know, the board can decide which programs, and to be honest with you, I think it's only going to be these two programs for the duration.
Okay. Third follow-up, if I could?
Yeah.
And the question I ask is, this bill would give the Board of Veterinary Examiners the ability to choose which of these accreditation or licensing regimens you would accept somebody to practice in Alaska through. Would you tend to use one or the other exclusively or mix and match as the case required?
No, we would use both of them. We would definitely not get rid of the ECFGV. That one would stay on, and PAVE would just be an additional way, a different pathway for them to come in.
Okay. And last question, could you speak briefly as to what was the what gave rise to this to PAVE as a new one starting in 2000? What was the need for a new licensing record?
Well, the ECFG is only once a year. They only offer it once a year, and it's very difficult for some people to get it taken in that one time period. And I think the PAVE programs, it's offered twice a year, and they do have a practical where they go down, and I mean, you can research the program yourself and see, but it's a good program. And I think it's just more, it's offered more, and this, the way it's been now is like this gal in Homer, she has to wait a year for this test, so she can't practice.
Actually, yeah, we just passed a bill that might allow that if her husband is an active duty military, she might be able to get a courtesy license.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Oh. Representative Holmes, followed by Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, Dr. Hunt, does the board have a position on House Bill 139?
I would think we would. We do. I think we would want this bill to pass so that way we can get the PAVE program passed.
And follow-up, Mr. Chairman? Would you have, it sounds like some of the concerns that have been raised deal not with the PAVE program so much as the impression that maybe this would lead to ambiguity in the statute. How would you feel about having the bill, instead of written the way it is, simply add the PAVE program as a second?
I don't have a problem with that. The only problem is down the road it might be more difficult because we're going to be going through the statutes again if something else happens. Like, I don't know if another program, I mean, we're talking 10, 20 years from now. I don't know. It's because it's a dynamic situation with the these programs, but like I said, to be honest with you, I think it's just going to be PAVE and ECFGV, and there's not going to be many more of these programs because they're very expensive to make and offer. So I guess either way, I do think that, you know, sure, it's a lot to ask the board to pick and choose which ones are valid and which ones aren't, but I don't think there's going to be any more programs. This is it. So you could either put PAVE in there or just leave it as it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
She asked my question.
Oh, okay.
I got my answer.
We're aligned.
Thanks again, Doctor.
Yeah.
Dr. Jim Delker.
Sorry,
Doctor. President of the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association. You with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for calling in today.
Yep, thank you. This is Dr. James Delker. I practice in Soldotna. I am the current president of the State Veterinary Medical Association. As Dr. Wilson has stated, we represent the majority of the practicing veterinarians in the state of Alaska, and we as an organization had formally adopted a resolution against House Bill 139, and our main reason for that was that presently the licensing standards and requirements that we have for veterinary medicine are clearly stated in statute through the Veterinary Practice Act, and that's the way we feel they should remain. We don't think that the bill should be subject to change through a revolving five-member board, although we respect that, you know, as veterinarians and as a layperson representing the veterinary community, they're going to do their best. There is subject to bias. And at, you know, at this point in time, there are basically the two programs that you've become acquainted with, and so I don't foresee there being more than that as well. I agree with Dr. Hunt that I think as the future goes, at least for the next 20 years, there's I don't see anything changing within that. But the problem is that I don't and we don't believe that we should give the board the power to select certification programs or something else were to come up, because in that instance, just giving a hypothetical, if a certain or a couple of members or even, you know, three out of the five members of the board agreed that, for instance, a veterinary school in India put out pretty good students that wasn't accredited by the AVMA and wasn't through ECFGG or PAVE, they could say, well, we think they do pretty good there, so we can just start accepting them, and then they're making the determinant of what equivalency is, and it may not be to the same standards that we have become accustomed to and have used as standards. So I don't think the bill as written is a good one, because I think that it leaves too much ambiguity, and it should provide we feel that the requirements should remain in statute. So a couple of other points, and I'll speak, you know, right now, speaking as the president of the state association, I'm speaking formally as representative, but I'll speak a little bit, if I may, after just kind of talking a little bit more about PAVE and some things that we have discussed and some research that I have done with PAVE, just to get you more familiar as well, too. But the purpose of this bill, or part of the purpose of this bill, was that we were going to try to increase the number of veterinarians in the state of Alaska, and I guess I don't see any evidence that this bill will really increase the number of veterinary services, especially to rural Alaskans. I think if we're trying to do that, we should look at other options like the National Veterinary Medical Services Act, which has allowed it five spots for rural veterinarians in Alaska, that they will do some form of loan repayment for the veterinarians who choose to do that. As well, the USDA FIS Student Loan Repayment Plan has some options available. And then as well, there are about 20 states presently that have loan repayment plans for rural DVMs or veterinarians who choose to serve in rural communities. So I think those are truly more effective and better ways to try to increase services to rural Alaskans. And so I don't think this bill is really going to address that issue at all. So. And then I guess lastly, just speaking a little bit about PAVE, one of the things that we haven't formed a formal position statement, so I'm kind of taking my AKVMA hat off now and speaking for myself, but we have discussed it in committee quite a bit. And one of the problems that we had with it is that there were two particular schools in the Caribbean that gained some kind of beneficial or seemed to have some favoritism in this process, and that was that they were not required to take a fourth or third or fourth year clinical competency exam as all other foreign graduates were. And how they got around this is that they would do a fourth year in a accredited institution somewhere in the United States, and by doing their first 3 years of veterinary work at the non-accredited school, they could do 1 year at the accredited school, and they could skip this clinical competency test. And as a committee, we, you know, the general consensus at that point was that this really isn't fair or equitable, because they're not having to take the same test that all of the foreign graduates are, and that's one of the reasons that it's not approved in all states at this point in time. PAVE is not a bad program; it's actually a very good program, but it is not equitable in all situations, and we don't believe that that is fair, and I don't believe that that's fair to let, you know, these students from just two particular schools in the Caribbean, who, you know, get benefit of not having to follow the same standards. And so that's kind of where there's a little bit of a rub with the PAVE. Now, interestingly, just last week, I think within the last 10 days, one of those two schools has gained AVMA accreditation, so it's no longer an issue. So essentially there's only one school right now that is getting those benefits, so to speak, and that school, I believe, is seeking accreditation. So it may become a moot point as far as the PAVE issue goes. But at any rate, so I guess that's any questions at that point?
Any questions for Dr. Dawson, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I would ask Dr. Ducker the same question I asked the earlier speakers, which is if the bill were to be changed to specifically just list the PAVE program as well as the current program and not give the discretion to the board to change the requirements, can you speculate on what the association would feel about that?
My guess is that it would be more palatable, but not necessarily completely accepted, because there still is, again, a little bit of discrepancy we feel in the PAVE situation.
Thank you. Oh, I have one more question, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay, follow up.
On a totally different note, I was just wondering on, I understand that Dr. Delker is Moe's veterinarian, and
oh, yes.
I don't know there's a question there, except how's Mo doing?
Dr. Tuomi was, who we will be getting to later, was my vet in Anchorage from 1977 to 1982, and had both of our Newfoundlands at that point in time. So I know a few of these people.
Okay. I'm not sure. Mr. Chairman?
Would it be possible? One more thing I'd like to state, I guess. The one thing that we might be looking into as an association is a possibility of opening our practice act at some point in the next couple of years. There's a new, what we call a model practice act that was put out by the American Veterinary Medical Association to kind of try to get some of the states to update their practice acts and to make sure that they were in line and current with current standards of practice and medicine. And we're going to try to take a look at that over the next year and potentially address that at our next meeting next October. And so depending on what happens with the PAVE thing, it's not to say that we will accept it, but I think there's a possibility that we could at least take a look at it and see if that, address it at that point in time, because I think there's a chance that we may be opening the Practice Act or looking to try to do that within the next year or two to try to make some changes and adjustments to come in line with that Model Practice Act.
Thanks. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Commissioner Chair. Dr. Delker, just a question. What's the current supply and demand equation for veterinarians in Alaska? I understand there are some shortages in the rural areas, but in general, is there a shortage of veterinarians in Alaska?
My perception is that it can be somewhat difficult in some of the smaller communities. I don't know so much in the Anchorage community. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not an easy task, but I've always been able to fill the positions that I've had at my practice. I've been practicing in the state since 2003, so I've been here a relatively short period of time. There may be other veterinarians that can speak to that a little bit more than myself.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up?
Certainly.
Sir, Doctor, I'm actually reading through a number of the letters and emails we've gotten in opposition to this. Many of them make the point that the passage of this bill would lead to a diminishment of standards for veterinary practice. But I heard you say that you thought the PAVE accreditation system was pretty decent. In your opinion, would this bill actually lead to a degradation of the standards of veterinary practice in Alaska?
I wouldn't say specifically it would, but it could potentially, because if they were allowed to accept anything other than PAVE or ECFVG, then the hypothetical that I gave with other schools and other countries, they could say, well, if the examining board felt, well, maybe those were, close enough or adequate, you could see a potential degradation of that. So I think that there is definitely a potential for that if you have some ambiguity in your statutes.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks again, Jim.
Yep, thank you.
Next up, Dr. John Basler, Anchorage.
Hi, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. Thank you for taking our testimony. I'm Dr. John Basler. I am here as a representative of the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association also. I am the delegate from the state of Alaska to the AVMA, so this is a topic that's been discussed there as well. And I am on board with the association's opposition to the bill. My background is a practicing veterinarian in Alaska since 1985. I do have the perspective of spending 3 years in rural Alaska practicing in the North Slope Borough as a employee of the borough traveling to rural villages. And I would concur that I don't think this bill is going to bring a significant number of new practitioners to Alaska that are going to alleviate anything in rural Alaska. That's driven more by economics and what people are able to pay and willing to do to take care of their animals. And I think my own personal and professional concern with the bill is just that it does create that ambiguity. It, granted, will allow the Board of Examiners to accept PAVE, but it also leaves it wide open to at any future point in time accept any other process. And, at this point, the PAVE may become a moot point if that final school does become accredited. Then we would be just back to the ECFG as the only route there. So my own personal opposition is mostly just that, is that it does create some ambiguity. It leaves wide open as to what's acceptable and what's not. And there has been a lot of work nationally through both the AVMA and through the National Board of Veterinary Examiners to try to really standardize and provide pretty set specific guidelines on what every veterinarian should have. And those really aren't designed as a barrier of entry, but more as a measure of competence of anybody who's allowed to practice.
Representative Thompson, two questions.
No, just one. Thank you. Out of curiosity, everybody keeps referencing that that the PAVE program and the ECFVG program are acceptable, but you're worried about other programs. And is there other ways of getting licensed out there? Are there other programs out there that aren't as in-depth or at all? I mean, is there something else?
Currently, the only two programs that are out there within the United States are the ECFVG program and the PAVE process. Like Dr. Delker said, the PAVE process was pretty specifically designed for these Caribbean veterinary schools to try to get an accreditation around the ESVG without having their full accreditation.
Follow?
Yes.
There are certainly quite a few other countries that do have veterinary programs, and on occasion I have met people from other programs in other countries, and it really depends a lot on the country as to what the caliber of what they've been taught is. So if you go European Union, probably you're going to find an education is extensive and qualified as here, whereas if you go to, say, South America or Africa or India, then they're going to probably be dealing with a program that is nothing similar to what a U.S. veterinarian would be taught.
Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Basler, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but I have to admit that each of the people testifying against the bill, each of the organizations, I get the overwhelming concept that you folks just don't trust the people that would be on the board. Is that an accurate statement?
That would not be an accurate statement. The people on the board are our colleagues. I think that generally legislation should be clear and unambiguous and should not just leave anything open-ended. So, no, do I distrust my colleagues? I actually applaud them for taking the time out of their personal lives. That's one thing that I feel is being a professional is that people are willing to do that as part of being on a profession. And so, I actually admire the board members for taking the time to do that.
And I certainly, as a layman, I'm certainly no physician. I'm certainly not qualified to be a veterinarian. I would have to defer to their judgment and from testimony from people like you. When I read this bill, I don't see that we've opened a door other than to ask fellow veterinarians, probably part of your organization, to simply have the right, to simply have the ability to take a look and design a program for someone who doesn't automatically fit into the existing standards. And I'm guessing that you see this in a whole different light.
I think that when you look at, as Dr. Delker had stated on the National Model Practice Act, is that there is a big push nationally to try to standardize veterinary practice acts across the country, so they are much more uniform. And I guess, in my opinion, this would take us away from that rather than toward that.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks again, Doctor.
Thank you.
Dr. Pam Twomey, are you with us?
Mike is still on. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Dr. Pam Twomey. I am here today just representing myself as a previous member of the Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners and a veterinarian who's been practicing in Alaska since 1970, license number 53.
And my former vet for 5 years a long time ago. I'll declare the conflict of interest.
Right. I was on the board at the time when some of these statutes were adopted. And when I first came on, we actually wrote and administered a large portion of the exam on an individual state basis. And so I was around knowing the difficulty of taking a group of average practitioners who happen to be appointed by the governor and willing to volunteer their time to show up periodically to design and oversee the licensing process, such that we were felt very responsible that we were allowing individuals to have licenses to practice in the state of Alaska indefinitely based on our adjudication. And so we welcomed the ability to go with the national examining processes with the clinical competency test and with the foreign graduate certification program, because this allowed us to use the expertise of national academics to verify that our applicants were meeting standards that were valid nationwide as well as in the state of Alaska. My problem with the bill as it is written is that it does potentially throw a door open. And although we do trust our board members and know what a difficult job they have, it's the governor who appoints them, and they serve at the will of the governor. And if there were a bias at some point or pressure, like this one individual who just doesn't feel like she wants to spend $6,000 to earn the right to have a license in the state of Alaska, that we shouldn't be rewriting practice acts for those kinds of reasons. We have valid routes for licensure right now. They protect the public health of Alaska as well as the welfare of our pets and the welfare of our clients. And I just don't like the wide open door that has been offered or actually foisted upon the board by the wording in this bill. I think the current system works quite well. If the board wanted to try to put specific wording like Dave in there and felt that that was possible, I would be happier with that than I am with the wide open A certification program, not even capitalized. So that's my testimony.
Pam, do you see this bill bringing any vets into rural Alaska or bush Alaska?
I don't see it bringing very many vets into Alaska, period. And that's another reason why the way it's written, I'm not sure that it's a benefit to the state of Alaska, and the potential, although it might not be great for harm, is the potential for harm is still greater than the benefit that it would create.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Dr. Twomey, I just want to clarify, make sure I heard you correctly. You're saying that you don't like the wide-open language that would allow the board to choose its own accreditation. You'd feel more comfortable, not entirely comfortable, but less uncomfortable if the language of the bill did specify PAVE specifically. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's strictly a personal perspective.
Thanks again for testifying, Pam. Catherine Versteeg?
Yes.
Am I close?
Hi there. I'm Dr. Catherine Versteeg, and I'm also a practicing veterinarian here in the state of Alaska, and am past president as well as the Alaska VMA And I don't have a lot new to add, but just also oppose this bill as written. And I have done work as well in rural Alaska, and I'm in fact working with nonprofits to try to increase veterinary representation out in rural Alaska because it is certainly needed. But I just don't think this bill will do anything to assist that. And I do think that it's better if we just have our certification program in statute versus just having that gray zone that things can be changed. So essentially that's what I think.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us today. Mark May, Dr. Mark May, Fairbanks. One was easy. Jonathan Musman.
Hi, this is Jonathan Musman.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Jonathan Musman. I'm a constituent of Representative Wilson. I'm representing myself and my wife.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. Please continue.
I would like to first thank Representative Wilson for sponsoring this bill and the committee for hearing it. I originally contacted the VME, the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, in early 2009 regarding acceptance of PAVE, and I was told that I needed to contact my representative to begin this process. A little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago, Representative Wilson sponsored a bill to attempt to change the Practice Act, which was strongly opposed by the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Board. And one of the reasons why was a potential merger of the ECFVG and the PAVE. Our understanding from speaking to the executive director of the PAVE program, Ms. Erin Jones, is that any potential merger is years and years away. When, as I've heard the testimony today, people talk about there not being any benefit to Alaska, I can tell you there will be two Alaskans that would see some benefit to Alaska if my wife could work in the state. The last year and a half, she's had to fly to Washington and California to work at all. And for about 6 months last year, she was basically living three weeks a month in Washington to try to work and keep her skills sharp. So there would be two Alaskans I know that would be feel some benefit to the PAVE being accepted in Alaska. When people talk about the cost of taking the ECFVG, the question comes is why doesn't your wife just take the ECFVG? The actual test only costs $5,000, but the typical process time is at least 12 months, closer to 24 months. And as has been stated before, a minimum of two trips to a testing center is what's required for the to take the exam. Her classmates that have gone through the ECFVG process have made more than three trips typically to complete the testing process. And that's all I have.
Any questions for Mr. Musman? Thanks again. Karen Ewing, are you with us?
Yes, I'm the executive director of the Idaho Board of Veterinary Medicine.
Oh, could, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you bet. This is Karen Ewing. I'm the executive director of the Idaho Board of Veterinary Medicine, and the Idaho Board had changed its rules in 2007 in order to accept PAVE, and we have not had any problems whatsoever with the PAVE program, and I have found my board members to be extremely qualified to make decisions about what a proper testing program is to determine if a foreign graduate does meet the same competency standards as an American, or, you know, as a graduate of an AVMA accredited university. I think that the public can have great faith in their veterinary board members on that. We'd had a board member who was on the PAVE development committee, and he found the program to be outstanding. The thing is that what we're finding with PAVE graduates who are now applying to Idaho, because we've had it in place now, where we allow PAVE graduates and ECFEG, PAVE has been accepted for about 4 years now, and we've basically had an increase of about 5% of our licensees are now PAVE graduates, and we've also found that the majority of these foreign graduates are actually United States, you know, people who grew up and went to school in the United States for all of their other, grade school, junior high school, and their bachelor's degrees. And then they've gone to foreign non-accredited schools for veterinary college. And so we found that probably about 95% of the PAVE certificates who have been licensed in Idaho are actually people who grew up in the United States. And in Idaho's case, this all started because we did have a student in a foreign university who wrote to the board and said, "Hey, I'm a native Idahoan. When I graduate from school, I'd sure like to be able to come and practice back in my home state. And I'm enrolled in the PAVE program, and you do not accept it." So that was the impetus for the board to do a great deal of research about PAVE. They found it to be an exceptional program, at least as good as the AVMA's ECFEG program. And so, again, I think that the public in general can trust their board members to be qualified to make these decisions. And I'd sure answer any questions that you had about Idaho's experience.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Briefly, Mr. Chair. Karen, do I understand that you are representing the Idaho Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners? Or are you speaking for yourself or on behalf of the board officially?
But on behalf of the board, basically, just again to describe what Idaho's experience has been, in case that would help you in any manner.
Thank you,
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Karen, for calling in with your testimony. Do you folks have a board that's set up similar to what we are discussing here? A five-member board, four of them being appointed. Veterinarians appointed by the governor, and I guess one other appointee. Do you have a board that resembles that?
Yes, sir. Basically, we have five licensed veterinarians and one public member. So we actually have a six-member board. And as I said, one of our former board members had been on the PAVE committee, and then one of our current public member she's also been elected to be the public member on the National Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners, and it was the National Board that created the qualifying exam that's part of the PAVE program, and also the National Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners created the Veterinary Clinical Skills Assessment Test that is part of the PAVE completion pathway. But we are very, very similar to Alaska, other than just having that an additional veterinarian member.
So once follow up, please. Once the statute in Idaho had been modified to permit looking at a PAVE certified veterinarian, then you and your board created whatever additional criteria, testing, certification, etc., in order to test each individual person that came before you?
Well, basically, in Idaho's case, our authorizing statute, basically where we talk about the contents of a license application and what the qualifications are, the way our statute was originally written, it actually gave authority. It specifically mentioned, students who or graduates of non-accredited universities, and specifically mentioned the ECFEG program, that would be an acceptable pathway to prove educational equivalence. But then we also had in that same section, after we talked about the ECFEG program, we also said that you could show the equivalency. It could be completion of any educational equivalency program established for the purpose of evaluating an individual's educational knowledge and clinical skills as they relate to the practice of veterinary medicine and as approved and outlined by the rules of the board. So basically, we did not have to change our statute, and we just added a rule that basically incorporated the PAVE program by reference, where we'd also had the ECFEG program incorporated by reference. We just added the PAVE program in that same incorporation section.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, you put all of those things in place, and you've seen no diminishment in the capability of those folks that you have allowed to be licensed.
That is correct. We have not had any problems in the 4 years that we've been accepting foreign graduates who have gone through the PAVE program. We've not received a single complaint against any of those persons, nor have we done any disciplinary actions. Whereas we actually have had disciplinary actions in the past against ECFEG graduates. But again, it's so much based on the individual person, because I do believe that both the ECFEG program and the PAVE program are both excellent programs to determine educational equivalency for somebody who's gone to a non-accredited university.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome.
And thanks again for joining us today. We have one last person signed up, Dr. Hollick. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Could you please state your name?
Dr. Marianne Hollick. I live in Eagle River, Alaska, and have been a licensed Alaskan veterinarian for over 20 years. In addition to clinical practice, I previously owned and operated a large veterinary hospital in Anchorage for many years. I object to House Bill 139. This bill would delete the requirement for the nationally AVMA-recognized testing standard. In my opinion, Alaskan pet owners receive and deserve the best care. And as a previous small business owner, it is troubling for me to see bills of this nature. Given that we enjoy the highest standard, for me, the measure can only imply that the standards in Alaska will be reduced. It will create uncertainty for our practices from year to year as we await the actions of the board. I request that you do not adopt this measure. In addition to that, I have personally visited the non-accredited Caribbean veterinary schools and met with their dean. I've done this within the last 6 months. They do not have a veterinary teaching hospital. They provide no clinical training until those students come to the United States. In addition, a non-accredited university is not the same as an accredited U.S. university. The AVMA has decided to accept ECFEG and not to accept PAVE. If at some point where the AVMA accepts the AVE, then I would suggest we reconsider this. But until that time, I do not believe that the two are separate and equal. Thank you for your thoughts.
Any questions for Dr. Hollick? Is there anybody online?
Nobody else.
With that, I'm going to hold this bill over, and I'm going to keep the public testimony open. But brief at ease, and do we need next item on the calendar? Actually, last item on the calendar for today is House Bill 11, Colonoscopy, Public Employee Retirees. And presenting the bill is Representative Guerra. And bring up one staff, if that helps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mascara, District 23, and my aide, Rose Foley. Thank you for hearing the bill. in the state of Alaska, there's only one group of people who do not get colonoscopy coverage. All people covered by private insurance plans get it by law. State employees get it by law. The most vulnerable group out there is the one that doesn't get it, and that's the retired public employees covered by that plan. Colonoscopy coverage is important for a number of reasons. I mean, number one, it's the third leading cancer killer in the country. It is especially dangerous for those over 50. That's when you really should start screening. And those are the folks who just aren't covered right now under the law. With screening, if you detect cancer early, there's a 90% rate of survival of longer than 5 years. Without screening and you don't detect early, there's a 10% rate of survival over 5 years. This bill just asks that coverage be granted to those under the Retired Public Employees Plan consistent with the standards adopted by the American Cancer Society. It's usually a colonoscopy. Sometimes it's something else. It's what the doctor and the patient agree to. By way of note, and I'm not sure if anybody knows why, the Alaska Native population suffers from colon cancer at a 2-to-1 rate over the Caucasian population. Nobody is sure why. And there's also an alternative blood test that, for some reason, genetically is especially dangerous to Alaska Natives, which makes a colonoscopy more important for that population as well. And others who know more about it, who are here in the audience, can explain to you why. There have been a few studies on the costs of providing colonoscopy coverage. We're pretty surprised by the fiscal note the state has provided. They provided a fiscal note that shows a $4 million cost. The studies that you'll hear about from the American Cancer Society, from others, and that we've looked at, show that you actually save money by providing colonoscopy coverage, that the cost of the colonoscopy or the other preventive care is more than offset by the cost that you would otherwise pay to treat somebody who develops cancer from not getting the screening. There's a study by the Lewin Group that says that. There's a study you have in your packet that's called the Buck Report. And the Buck Report shows that if you start granting screening to those over 50, you save likely some amount of money compared to not granting the screening and having to pay for cancer coverage afterwards. State's fiscal note seems to, we're not sure where they got their numbers from, but if you read the last sentence of the state's fiscal note, it said colonoscopy coverage for everybody compared to not providing it costs $4 million. We don't want it for everybody. If you're 20 years old, you don't need a colonoscopy. If you're 30, you don't need a colonoscopy. It may be that they found some study that said that measured the cost of providing it for everybody. We have online just to answer questions, but he knows the issue very well, Dr. Ward Hurlburt, and I think he could probably give you an idea on the comparative cost of providing and not providing the coverage. We have Dr. Brian Sweeney. I'm not sure if he's in the audience or if he's online. And Dr. Brian Sweeney also is well-versed in the area. Emily Neenan from the Cancer Society is well-versed in the area. I think somebody from AARP will testify, and somebody from the Retired Public Employees Association will testify. I could provide you more information, but it's probably going to be duplicative of what those folks are going to provide you and probably less credible, given that they've studied the issue longer than I have. So I'm happy to take questions, but...
Since you are last and we have limited time, we have Brian Sweeney online. We have...
Pardon
me? Hurlburt? Yeah. Oh, no, I'm just, Ward Hurlburt. Who would you like first?
Dr. Hurlburt, I understand, is just there to ask questions, and I think he could answer the questions about the relative costs of granting colonoscopy coverage and not, and other questions. And Dr. Sweeney, I think, I believe practices in the area. I'm not positive, but he is there to testify. Dr. Hurlburt is there to take questions from the
committee. Any questions for the sponsor before we go to Dr. Hurlburt? Dr. Hurlburg, are you with us?
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear that as they unmuted it.
Oh, please join us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And Representative Gary had some questions out there that he thought you could flesh out the answers on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ward Hurlburg. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health, Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services. And it's coincidentally, by my background, I'm a general surgeon who dealt for many decades with colorectal cancer. So I'm here to respond to any questions.
Representative Gura had several that he'll repeat. I think we probably lost you during the questions.
Dr. Hurlburg, I don't know what information you have, probably better than I do. We have looked at the Buck report and the Lewin report on trying to determine whether providing colonoscopy screening saves money over not providing it and paying for the cancers that end up as a result. The state's taking the position that, or the Department of Administration takes the position that it costs more money to provide the screening than it does save money in terms of cancer costs. And I'm wondering if you have a view on those, on that, whether it's a cost-effective thing to do.
Through the chair, I have not done an analysis on the cost, and the fiscal note, of course, comes from the Department of Administration, so I can't comment on that. As I've been familiar with colorectal cancer screening, and I should state that when I talk about it, I talk about it in the same sense that the Centers for Disease Control does. They had a document just this morning that recommends colorectal cancer screening for individuals aged 50 to 75, meaning either fetal occult blood testing every year or flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, or colonoscopy every 10 years, one of those three. So not specifically colonoscopy. It doesn't just address that. The colonoscopy is the most expensive way of those three to do that. But in public health circles, because colorectal cancer is a cancer that early intervention, as you stated in your early testimony there, Representative Kara, that it is a cancer that early intervention can make a real difference on, contrasted with some other kinds of cancer, like where the odds are not as good, like lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, that preventive efforts where you can either identify lesions like a benign polyp that can become malignant and remove it while it's still benign, or probably more commonly pick up an early cancer and remove it while it's still localized, greatly increases the odds that you have of surviving from the cancer. And so over the long term, if you bring in the costs of end-of-life care for people who have cancer, those are costs which will balance it. I do not have a specific analysis, though, on the immediate costs. I think it's reasonable to think that in the short run, when you start a program for people who have not had coverage, that your costs will be there and the savings will come further down the road.
Thank you, Mr. Hurlburg. And I guess I don't have any other questions unless the committee does.
Well, then I think we'll go on to Dr. Brian Sweeney.
Hello?
Dr. Sweeney?
Yes.
Thank you for joining us today. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record? And you've got our undivided attention.
My name is Brian Sweeney, Sr. I'm a member of the American College of Gastroenterology. I was asked to speak in place of my son, who is a member of the Alaska Colorectal Council, who could not speak today. I'm until recently a practicing gastroenterologist in Anchorage. I retired about a week ago, and would be happy to speak on the subject. I had sent forward the American College of Gastroenterology guidelines for Dr. Guerra's office, to Wes Guerra's office. I don't know if you have those or not, but they basically give the guidelines that are present for all insurers in the state of Alaska, with the exception of the retired employees. I can address a few of the things I've heard previously. A number of studies have shown the cost effectiveness long term of doing colonoscopy cancer screening. One of the dilemmas you run into is that people at 65 become Medicare, and for any specific entity that's making the payment, it might not be cost effective in the short term over a period of a year or two, but later on, when these folks become Medicare age, you do reap the cost benefits of having the screening done. Recent studies have shown a decline in colon cancer rates by about 30%, and this has been attributed to the aggressive screening procedures that began about 8 years ago. And drops were seen even before then as gastroenterologists around the country began taking a more aggressive approach to screening. It's in the study for people who've had polyps who are identified as high-risk cancer patients. There have been a number of studies done where they followed them up over 10 to 15 years and noted a decline of 90% in the degree of new cancers in those folks who are in a high-risk category for developing new cancers. So American Cancer Society has developed their guidelines, and quite reasonably the legislature adopted those guidelines for the coverage of almost everybody in Alaska a number of years ago, and we were all very happy to see that as practicing gastroenterologists, because when you deal with patients, a lot of times they know what they should do, and they listen to you tell them what they should do, but if there's a financial hardship for them to do it, or if it's not covered, it makes it much more difficult to get them to proceed and have the procedures that are best for them. And I have seen retired state employees deny themselves colonoscopies because of the lack of coverage in my years of practice here. I would strongly recommend that you include those folks in the coverage that everybody else in Alaska has, and be willing to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Dr. Sweeney? Thanks again. Do we have anybody else online?
Molly.
Oh, Emily.
Oh,
Molly McCannon. Oh, Molly McCannon.
Yes, this is Molly McCannon.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for participating today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Molly McCannon, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 11, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself. In 1997, I was a state employee, 45 years old, and diagnosed with stage 1 colorectal cancer, following a colonoscopy paid for by my state health insurance. I knew my grandfather had died of colon cancer himself at the age of 45, but a grandparent is a second degree relative. I wasn't too concerned, but my doctor recommended a colonoscopy anyway. My symptoms were very minor, and I'm sure I would have ignored them if state insurance had not covered the procedure. Fortunately, I was able to be scoped, and my tumor was found early enough that I could have it surgically removed and avoid radiation and chemotherapy treatments. I'm now 59 and a state retiree, and screening colonoscopies are not covered by my health insurance. This seems totally absurd to me. My body continues to want to make cancer, as evidenced by numerous precancerous polyps removed over the last 13 years. If left in place, these polyps would have developed into cancerous tumors that would have required extensive treatment at a substantial cost, yet this is considered routine screening. I know the American Cancer Society recommends routine screening for colorectal cancer starting at age 50, unless your family history indicates otherwise. And I know I'm going to make sure my kids, two boys, start screening at least by age 40, if not sooner. The Cancer Society believes that preventing colorectal cancer, and not just finding it early, should be a major reason for getting tested. And the best way for doing that is through a colonoscopy. This cancer is so treatable if caught early enough. Yet a colonoscopy is an expensive enough procedure that it's just kind of human nature, the human tendency to postpone or to avoid having it done until a tumor is either too large to ignore or the cancer is spread to other parts of the body. As a result of this screening and improved treatment, there are now more than 1 million survivors of colorectal cancer in the United States. I consider myself fortunate to be one of them and urge you to support this legislation so there will be more survivors like me. Thank you.
Thanks again, Molly. Emily, are you with us?
Yes. We're getting a lot
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for bearing with us on this.
No problem. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'm very pleased that the committee has taken up this issue. I've been working on this issue for the last 6 years. Just a little background, we heard already, I'm still getting a lot of feedback. I apologize. Seems to be corrected now. Thank you. And I'll just continue feedback and all. In 2006, when the state law was passed, that did require the full range of colorectal cancer screening for all state-regulated insurance plans. A number of other plans followed suit at that time. Plans such as Providence Health System, a self-insured plan, went ahead and added this coverage at the same time and on the same timetable as the state law going into effect. We know that at the time the law was passed, the active state employees already had this coverage and continue to have it. Some of the union trusts did not have the coverage, but they have also followed suit and added this over the years. So we really are looking at this retiree group, and specifically any retirees that fall in the 50 to 64-year-old age range. Medicare has had this coverage for some time, but there's been one more change effective January 1st of this year.
Emily, could you get a little closer to the mic? You're breaking up on our end. Thanks.
I'm breaking up on this end, too.
Oh, okay, so we're even.
I'm just checking with the LA staff here.
They're checking.
So. They can't hear me. I'm having trouble, too.
We're trying to take care of
this. I think it's more than the mic.
Completely.
Is there somebody working out on that?
Yes.
We're going to take a brief of these while they record. Are you with us, Emily?
Yes, I am. How's that?
Better, much better.
Oh, good. It's much better on this end, too. Good. Well, it's late Friday afternoon, and so I'll keep my comments brief. I'm happy to answer any questions either today or as this process moves forward. Just to sum up, though, we've made good progress in getting coverage. Medicare, as I was just starting to say, as of January 1st of this year, is actually now covering the full range of colon cancer screenings, including colonoscopy, at 100% with no copayment. This means there's no cost to the secondary health insurance that would affect the retiree plan. So we're really just looking at that 50 to 64-year-old. You've got the facts in front of you. Screening can prevent cancers, actually, from ever developing, which is pretty amazing and unique to colorectal cancer, that we have that ability. We want to take advantage of that opportunity to prevent cancer where we can. I'd be very interested to learn more about what went into the fiscal note. I do have some concerns with previous analysis of SUC consultants that I saw from 2007. A number of things, including the fact that they used the terms screening and diagnostic interchangeably, which says to me they weren't real clear about what they were talking about. So I will be very interested to learn more about that and happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I might add that's not the first time we've had problems with our actuaries, but we won't get into that one. But thanks again, Emily. Representative Sadler has a question.
Okay. Thank you, Emily. Quick question. We've got in front of us a document from Buck Consultants. My question is the relative efficacy of the different screening tests, the fecal occult blood test, flexible sigmoidoscopy, the barium enema and colonoscopy. Is that fair to assume that that's just a straight scale of what's less cost and therefore less effective? Is there a hierarchy of effectiveness of those four screening tests?
There are differences, through the chair, in the effectiveness of the screening tests. The reason that there are a number of tests is that that decision really needs to be made between the patient and the doctor. It depends on a number of factors, including what the patient is actually comfortable with doing. The colonoscopy has the highest success rate performance-wise, is the most sensitive test. It screens the entire colon and can find precancerous polyps, remove them at the time, which is great, but not necessarily the right test for everyone. I think Rep. Guerra mentioned earlier fecal occult blood testing, and one of the challenges in the Alaska Native population is that there's a high incidence of H. pylori infection, which is an infection of the stomach lining that causes low-grade bleeding over time, and that FOBTs are not used, fecal occult blood tests are not used in the Alaska Native population because they're just not accurate. I'd be happy to, there's more information, and I can get the members of the committee. The American Cancer Society actually just published a new version of colorectal cancer facts and figures. I only have that available online, but I've just ordered some to be sent to Juno. So.
And thank you. That helps. And I guess I might ask in the sponsor's hearing as well, it might be good to have just a chart or a grid showing what tests are covered for whom for the three populations you described, just so we knew what was already covered.
Sure. Through the chair, that you're only covered right now as a retired public employee if you show symptoms, so which is a problem, so, right? The whole point of screening is to try and catch you before you have the symptoms. So you can actually get a colonoscopy if there are symptoms that you have cancer. So that's the limitation in the state plan. You have to show symptoms, internal bleeding of polyps, whereas a colonoscopy will take out a precancerous polyp before it's bleeding. Emily can explain these things better, but that's the limitation of the state plan, is you only get these things after, some people would say it's too late.
Yeah. But my question actually is, are these other screening tests provided to, covered for retirees?
Only if you show symptoms first.
Gotcha.
You can't get any of these.
We've asked for clarification on that. It's my intent to. We've got three more people signed up. I'm going to run this until we get through the two people in the room and Richard Benavides, who's up next at the Anchorage LIO. Are you with us, Richard?
I certainly am.
And now, thanks again, Emily. I'm sorry, but we're going to try to get to everybody today. So, hope you bear with me. Good to hear your voice, Richard. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got us.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Benavides, and I want to thank Representative Guerra for sponsoring this bill and the committee for hearing the bill. Many of you know me as a legislative aide for Senator Betty Davis, and some of you have never even heard of me, and that's okay. The reason you don't know me is that for the last 3 years, I've not been able to attend the regular sessions in Juneau because I'm here in Anchorage receiving cancer treatment for stage 4 colorectal cancer that metastasized to my liver. Now, I have no doubt that the only reason I'm testifying this afternoon and not either deceased or in the final stages of life is because my doctor recommended that I have a colonoscopy during a routine physical, literally 1 week before I was due to catch a plane to Juneau in the 2008 session. Now, because it was covered by our state health plan, I had it done. I had no symptoms of any type, and as a matter of fact, every other test I took that day with my doctor, I passed with flying colors. So I was pretty stunned to learn that I had any cancer, let alone something as serious as stage 4 cancer. I was told that for the diagnosis that I received originally, that the average survival rate was 2 years. Now, since then, I've had 2 radiation treatments, 2 major surgeries, 5 months of good old sit-down and pump-it-into-your-veins chemotherapy, And as we speak, I'm on a new regimen of oral chemotherapy of 8 pills daily for 10 days on and 11 days off. But the point is that without this coverage for colonoscopies, I would not have known I had cancer, nor would I have done this on my own because I felt great. Now, this bill would allow retirees, which I now have a chance of eventually being, that same coverage that saved my life. Now, most of our state employees are over 50, which is the age this is recommended that you get a colonoscopy, so this bill makes great sense, and it'll save thousands of dollars by catching cancer before it becomes more serious or by preventing it altogether. Now, I saw the fiscal note, and I was pretty stunned, but more so the statement that stated, that said that the analysis determined that the cost of providing the test exceeds any potential savings resulting from a reduction in colon cancer diagnosis. Now, I would hope that any reduction in colon cancer diagnosis is a good thing. And I suppose that I could have saved the state thousands of dollars by not having the test and not knowing and just dying so they wouldn't have to spend the money to keep treating me to keep me alive. But I don't think that that's the kind of thing that we want to do as representatives of the state. That you, and I think that what this bill is a great idea because if I get better, and I retire, then I wouldn't be qualified because I'd have to show symptoms again in order to get a colonoscopy. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. So I urge you to pass this life-saving legislation. So thank you.
Richard, I had to declare a conflict of interest with two of the vets, so I'm going to declare one with you. I think both Representative Sadler and I have known you, for my case, 10 years. For Dan's, probably longer than that. And keep up the battle.
And in my case, he lives in my district, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay, so we all... Okay.
Well,
Hi, thanks, Richard.
Thanks again, Richard. With that...
Back to work.
Yeah, get back to work, Richard.
Oh, you're up. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Dahl, and I'm the president of the Retired Public Employees of Alaska. Our organization consists of some 2,200 members who have retired from positions with municipalities or with the state, including the legislature. And it's always a pleasure to talk to prospective future members. I'm here this afternoon to speak in support of House Bill 11 and to urge the Labor and Commerce Committee to give the bill its approval. Each year, the RPEA prepares its list of concerns to present to the legislative session, and this issue always emerges at the top. The reason is simple. Retirees are aware of the existence of this benefit for active employees and are acutely alert to its absence once they become retirees. There is implied in the coverage for active employees a belief in the efficacy of the procedure, a belief that it does in fact save lives. We think that's a good thing to do, and we hope the committee will agree. Its absence in coverage once an employee has retired has implications which drive it to the head of our list. You have heard or will hear from witnesses who will support the effectiveness of the procedure. Again, it does in fact save lives. We would only add that it's a benefit that we do not believe anyone will abuse. It's a procedure that no one will undergo who's not seriously concerned about maintaining good health. You have before you, I know, the letter of November 29, 2007 to the Division of Retirement and Benefits from Buck Consultants, hired by the division to examine issues such as the proposed colonoscopy's cancer screening coverage. Like all good consultants, Buck surrounds its recommendations with caveats, but it states not once, but four places in the letter, that implementation of a colonoscopy screening benefit is likely to produce a positive return on investment for Alaska care. You can find that said once on page 1, again on page 3, and twice on page 4. The phrase positive return on investment means that the state will save money and lives. We understand that likely does not mean certainly, but it does suggest that a trial might be in order, and we speculate that that's what Buck had in mind. Finally, there's an observation I'd like to make most emphatically. For us to bemoan the existence of an unfunded liability and at the same time resist the adoption of a likely cost-saving procedure on at least a trial basis is inexplicable. It suggests an effort to establish a bargaining position rather than address health care. HB 11 gives the House an opportunity to assert sound logic in this apparently irrational situation, and we urge the committee to report the bill favorably. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Well, thanks again, but you left off one of your titles.
Well,
it's for Andrea Dahl.
She's an important addition to my resume.
And a friend.
Thank you.
Marie. For the record, Marie Darling, who has been here many times, welcome back, and please state your name and affiliation.
My name is Marie Darling, and I'm representing AARP, and you have our letter of support, I'm sure, before you, which, lateness of the day, I won't take time to go through all of it, just to say that we fully support this bill, and there's nothing like following Richard Benavides with his testimony. So, I do think you've heard everything you need to hear to know that this is something which really could save money, save lives, and that's what we're supposed to be doing with health care, as I understand it, for all state employees and retirees. And so, therefore, AARP is in full support of this bill.
You can tell somebody that has testified a number of times. Thanks again, Marie. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? I am going to hold the bill over. I am going to hold the public testimony open also. So with that, we will adjourn at 5:15.
All right. Good time.